Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm sitting in for Chris Kington Barker today. Chris needed to be out of town with some family things, so I get to do the program today talking about a fascinating topic, and we'll get into that part in a moment. I want to remind you that Central Coast Voices really has a goal of bringing you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. We want to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community, or in some cases, how lack of choices may affect our community, and want to look at the long-term ramifications of change or lack of change in our society. That's why we're here. We're glad you're joining us. I'll remind you a couple of times, this is a call-in program. If you want to call in, it's 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. The topic of the program today is Covered California. And since this is radio, you can't see my notes, but I have to kind of say, there's no really good way to put this out, and that is it's Covered California with a couple of question marks after it, because we want to really know whether or not California is adequately covered or not. And that's what we're going to talk about today. In March of 2010, then-President Barack Obama signed a Comprehensive Health Reform Act known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, ACA, into law. It is called Obamacare. I'm still not sure if it's called Obamacare by people who like to call it Obamacare or people who don't like the bill, so they therefore call it Obamacare. But we will call it the ACA or the Affordable Care Act today because that's its real name. Most experts would agree that the Affordable Care Act has increased the availability of health insurance to many Americans, as well as not only their health insurance, but their access to care because they are then insured. When Obama took office in 2009, more than 50 million people were uninsured in the United States. That's 17% of the population. And since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, that number, according to the Census Bureau of last year, has dropped to 8.8%. And that's really a good thing for most of us who believe that people should be able to get health care without having to worry about whether or not they can get health care. The ACA Act is not without issues. Today, I'm going to speak with Frederick Aguilera, who is the Affordable Care Program Coordinator for the Community Health Centers of the Central Coast, and Joel Derringer, who's a principal of Derringer and Associates, and Susan Funk, who's the president of Kalos Group. And we're going to look at basically what the program is doing now, what the challenges are for the program, and how things in California may affect how we can proceed with better health care for most of us. And that's really where we're going. For clarification, because I've explained to you that Frederick is the ACA program coordinator for the Community Health Centers of the Central Coast, that's easy to understand. But I also probably should clarify that Joel Derringer is basically a veteran local health care policy consultant and an advocate for health care. And Susan Funk is a consulting health care management, officer or a consultant, for lack of a better way of putting it. Sorry, I didn't have better words together for that. And she's been doing that for 25 years. And also for clarification, because my name is Fred, and Frederick's name is Frederick, we will not confuse the two of us today, which makes it easy because Frederick goes by Frederick, and it occasionally comes up. It's difficult to say where we want to jump into this. I'm going to try and look at this from a standpoint of not only where we are, but how we got here over the last couple of years. Is the ACA Act doing what it was intended to do up front, and is it doing it effectively? And I'll just throw that on the table and jump out of the way. This is, by the way, I've known Joel Derringer a long time. For Joel not to jump in instantly like that, it was very surprising. So, Joel, go ahead, grab it.
I think I can jump in just from a ground level perspective, just because I am in the field and I do see it probably more frequently. But I definitely feel that it is. I do think that there are aspects in some individual consumer situations that don't always line up just right, but I think that for the most part, I really have seen a lot of the benefits of the ACA working for patients, and I see a lot of patients regard the ACA and the reasons for having health insurance as life-saving. And I think that that's really important to remember. And to hear people in the very beginning criticize it so much and now see people thanking the Affordable Care Act or the individual mandate for having to have health insurance as a way of saving their lives and making them healthier people. And I think that that's really important. I think that's the message that we're always trying to send to people is you regardless, you still need to focus on your health and stay healthy. And I think that that's really important.
Yeah. Some of the perception we've heard about is, and there have been some anecdotal references to this. You ask some people who were not in favor of the Affordable Care Act, they may say things to you like, you know, the Affordable Care Act really was lousy law and it's too much government meddling. But, you know, Covered California is great. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be a lot of perception-driven material as opposed to reality. Because I think the average person doesn't know what they get with Covered California and isn't really sure about the Affordable Care Act. We've heard an awful lot about the mandate program, and a lot of folks in Washington in the current administration and friends of the administration are saying that, well, by removing the mandate, we've basically intentionally killed the Affordable Care Act because we couldn't kill it any other way. Has the removal of that mandate really affected that? And I guess precisely, is the removal of the mandate going to affect California very much?
Well, the mandate, that doesn't go into effect yet. So one of the tricks with this kind of legislation in the tax bill where the individual mandate for health insurance was removed is that it sets up a scenario where over time it will be tough in states that don't impose their own individual mandates. It will be difficult to sustain the individual insurance market. But it's a slow-motion crash. It's not going to happen right away. And so people may think that it's actually not harmful when, in fact, it's setting up over time a scenario where people have the incentive to increasingly not to buy insurance until they get really, really sick, because then they know that the insurance company will have to issue it to them. And that set in that scenario, it means that the healthy people are out of the insurance pool and the sicker people are staying in the insurance pool because they are desperate. And that means that the cost of it rises and rises and rises, and more people bail out every year, and it sets up what really is a death spiral for an individual insurance market. And that will happen in those states that don't defend their individual insurance markets with state-level action.
So at the national level, the position of the majority of Republicans is it never should have happened. It should just go away. Is the efforts they're making now going to create a scenario that's going to prove the point, if you will, that it's too expensive and not obtainable, and therefore we're going to prove that we never should have had it? Or will it survive in spite of those people who are working real hard to remove it?
Well, I think Susan brings up a good point in that California is different than the rest of the country. And what we hear about going on nationally is not, in fact, happening in California. But let's go back to your original question, which has the Affordable Care Act achieved its purposes? Well, I think that calls for what do you think its purpose was? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If its purpose was to increase coverage, insurance coverage, it definitely achieved that. You can see that. You know, you cited the statistics how the rate of uninsured has dropped almost in half. In our county and in California, it's dropped by more than half. At the same time, it increased the number of people who could – one is everyone could get insurance because it removed any pre-existing condition exclusions. And secondly, it provided subsidies for people. So we've added 5,000 or more people in San Luis Obispo County to the Medi-Cal or Medicaid rolls. So they're now in SenCal. SenCal now covers – at least 1 in 5 people in San Luis Obispo County, probably even higher in Santa Barbara County.
Which is why I see offices for SenCal pretty much all over the county.
Well, that's CHC. SenCal is a Medi-Cal health plan.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Community health centers is actually
a safety net. So we,
it's a clinic.
We're contracted with them, and so they are one of our largest payers.
So they're a beneficiary of this as well.
Exactly. We're primary care physicians for SoCal beneficiaries.
Okay, and you have the primary contract with the state of California to provide medical care.
Just with SLO County, and then we are also present in northern Santa Barbara County.
So Community Health Centers is a clinic system. Mm-hmm. They have private insurance, but it's mostly Medi-Cal.
Right, so we're federally qualified.
And the uninsured.
Right, so we're a federally qualified health clinic organization, and we're really meant to provide as much care not only to the underserved, but the uninsured, mm-hmm. And also to those who have health insurance.
Yeah. You have some information on your website, which is already on the website for this program, so people can get that as far as the open enrollment period and such. Do you just happen to be one provider who's providing assistance with open enrollment, or for the state of California, are you the primary channel to do open enrollment in this county?
There are thousands of entities who are contracted with Covered California in the state. However, we are one of the largest in this area. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few now. In the beginning, there weren't very many. I think it was really difficult to partner with Covered California. There were a lot of dynamics around that, but we were very thankful to have been able to partner with them in a way that helps us spread the word to our patients about the importance of coverage and what it is that they really need to know. I think that that's really important too. So we are still actively involved as a partner with Covered California, and our biggest role now is been more about patient education or consumer education. What do I do when I don't have insurance anymore? What happens when I lose it? What happens when I get a new family member? You know, so we're there to help them through every step of the process. And we actually have an open enrollment event this Saturday at our San Luis Obispo office at 77 Costa Street. We'll be there from 9 to 1. It's a walk-in event, so anyone can walk in and ask questions or even get enrolled if they need to.
Yeah, and as I said before, if people are interested, if they go to the KCBX website and go on the link for this program today, which is already up, I've checked it and it works.
Correct.
It'll go to an information site for your organization also.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think one thing to understand, though, as we talk about Covered California and the Affordable Care Act, is Covered California is one small part of the act and actually a relatively small part of how people get health insurance. So probably 5 to 7% of the population at most is covered under Covered California in our county. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at it, as I said, 20% are on SoCal or Medi-Cal, 21% are on Medicare. Probably half receive some sort of employer-supplied insurance. So when we talk about the individual market, as Susan said, you know, the controversy over the individual mandate affects the individual market, but it's actually a relatively small market and way that people get covered.
Well, this may be a little off topic, but it comes to mind because I think it's an issue that affects a lot of people. There's a perception that healthcare in California or healthcare anywhere is way too expensive. From personal experience recently, I can tell you that having to use an emergency room recently, out of San Luis County, by the way, but my insurance covered it. Looking at what the emergency room cost would have been if I did not have insurance. By the way, I'm not insured under Covered California. I'm covered under my spouse's, who's a public employee, her insurance program. But looked at the cost that if John Q. Public with no coverage had walked into that emergency room, the bill they would have walked out with was about $9,000, and that's considered a cheap emergency room bill. When I looked at it after my insurance company covered it, they only paid about $3,000, but the hospital considered that to be 100% of their contracted coverage. So I'm still concerned that we have a healthcare system that not only for a lot of people who don't have insurance is very expensive, but we also have a system that seems to favor contracted services through insurance organizations as a less expensive alternative, which means if my insurance company only pays a hospital in San Jose one-third of the original billed amount, that hospital is looking at that as if I were an uninsured person, they would have made more money, so they've got to pass on that cost somewhere. And I'm wondering how that shifts back and forth. Go ahead, Susan.
I work with healthcare data and pricing data and cost data all the time. And so I'm very familiar with that. I'm also personally, as a small business owner, I'm an enrollee in Covered California. I don't have a subsidized plan, but I get my insurance on the individual market. And so I, like you, have one of those lovely $4,800 deductible plans. And I've seen those emergency room bills, too. I had that experience once. And part of the problem, providers have a practice, and some hospital systems have, this is a corporate financial practice, to significantly inflate the charges that they have. And there are reasons that that makes sense for them in terms of various contracts and discounts and games that they play with the prices.
They need to make up the discount they went to the insurance company with.
So right, but they're really the pricing levels get really high. And this is part of where the inflation in costs comes from, is that our system doesn't have any way to control the price of things. And so the individual players are duking it out in the market for how much power they can get in the market to command a higher price for their services from insurance companies or from individuals who may not have insurance to be able to get as much money as they can. And that's how we've organized the system. But this is where one of the real attractions is of the alternative Medicare for All type approach or single payer that would be in California done through SB 562. With that kind of a system, if there's one healthcare insurer in California that's essentially a public utility, you change, instead of having insurance companies that are answerable to their shareholders running things, you have in negotiating prices, in trying to get better deals than other insurance companies. You have instead one entity that's like a public utility that tells everyone, this is what we're paying for a colonoscopy. And every patient gets paid, you know, the same for the provider instead of lots of different prices. And it allows for much better control of the prices, similar to what they do in France and Germany.
So I'm glad you brought up single payer, because having read Senate Bill 562, the way I read it, it was all comers, all providers, all services, all payments, because I didn't see that cost control in there. And I, you know, maybe it's the dream to have it, but it actually, as far as I saw, was not in the bill. You know, it basically said any willing licensed provider can provide services. You can go to any provider and they can submit any bill. Now, and part of my, you know, while I really support the notion of single payer, the actual bill itself was totally lacking in what seemed to me any sort of management controls and cost controls. You know, maybe that's the dream down the road, but that wasn't in the bill.
You know, one of the challenges with SB 562 is that it was originally put through in the state Senate is effectively a shell bill that doesn't have a lot of details. And a financing study, a detailed study, had been commissioned, but it wasn't ready yet. So they went ahead and passed it in the state Senate, knowing that they were going to have to amend the legislation substantially to put the financing structure in place and those kinds of limits. So when I look at the SB 562, I'm looking at it from the perspective of the financing studies that the sponsors of the legislation are prepared to implement with a set of amendments once the legislation gets into a form that they can. Yeah, and that study assumes that everybody's effectively going to be paid at Medicare rates.
That's the UMass Amherst study.
Yes, the UMass Amherst study by Dr. Richard Pollan.
Okay. So what's – just for clarification, what's the current status of SB 562?
I'd say it's dead.
Okay. Well, it is past the state Senate. It is in the state assembly, and the speaker of the state assembly has bottled it up in the rules committee and is currently refusing to let it out. And the unfortunate thing about that is it means that there's no opportunity for hearings on the House side now, the assembly side, now that the financing study is available, so that we can't talk about the the real structure that's there. Because,
what the speaker did was appoint a select committee on universal care. And it's been holding hearings. It's co-chaired by Assemblyman.
I'd interject. At least they're holding hearings, which on the national level we didn't really see.
Right. Okay. Now, what they're doing is they're sort of starting over and trying to educate themselves. They've had several hearings on what's the current state of health coverage, what is happening in other states, what is happening in other countries. And they've had at least three hearings that I'm aware of, and it's co-chaired by a former emergency room physician, Joaquin Arambola, from Fresno, whose father was also in the assembly, and also a dentist, Jim Hill, from Sonoma County. And they've brought in state and national experts, and they're really starting over. I think part of what they're heading for is to create a constitutional right to health care within California. Where they get, you know, and the other thing is people conflate universal coverage versus universal care. So single payer, there are many ways to get to universal coverage or universal care. Single payer is one of them. So when you say I'm for single payer, does that mean you want everyone to have health insurance or that you want one payer, be that the federal or the state government, to control all the payments?
Well, I want to back up a little bit. First off, before we go any further, I get scolded by folks here sometimes not to remind people this is a program you can call in. We're talking with three guests today about health care in California and the Affordable Care Act and Covered California, among other things. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. Both your questions and your comments are welcome to be part of the program. Susan, you had something to jump in there with.
Yeah, one of the real attractions with single payer is that it does set up a scenario where where there's real market power on the payer side to set prices, and that's something that the other countries who have more diverse models have set prices, and we really don't have any capacity for that right now, and that. It contributes to America being the one thing we really excel in against in healthcare relative to all other countries is the cost. We're number one in how much it
absolutely.
Costs.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we spend 50% more than the next highest country, which is France. We spend 17% of our GDP on healthcare. Mm-hmm. We don't get a lot for it because we're the lowest among developed nations in terms of life expectancy. We have the highest infant mortality rates. We have the highest rates of chronic disease.
But we have a tremendous number of our citizens or our community members who believe that this is the best health care, and any place that there is, quote, socialized medicine, we're going to get inferior care. And that's not proven that because most of the developed world does indeed have some form of what could be considered socialized medicine. It's a word I'm careful when
well,
I use because
it's single payer is not necessarily socialized medicine. We're still talking about private providers.
Yeah.
You will
right.
go to the same doctors. Yeah. Tenet, the for-profit hospital system will continue to exist. Yeah. The community health centers, the nonprofit clinic system will continue to exist.
Well, we must have hit a nerve someplace. We have a few people who want to join the conversation. Let's jump in here. Okay, Dan from Templeton, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Susan, I have a question for you, please. How would SB 562 affect businesses, not just people, but businesses?
Oh, that's a great question, Dan. One of the real challenges that businesses face is that they're not experts in healthcare, but as Joel was mentioning earlier, about half the people in the county are getting their health insurance through businesses in their employer. So under the financing plan that's set forward for SB 562, the businesses would, instead of paying premiums and having to arrange that for their workers, they would pay a gross receipts tax of 2.3% on receipts over $2 million. What that means is this is especially great for small businesses because small businesses can't get the deals on health insurance that big businesses can. And they really struggle to be able to afford health insurance for their employees, or they have to go without, and then they lose their good employees to bigger employers. bigger employers that can pay for their health insurance premiums. So small employers would not have to pay much in gross receipts tax because most of them don't earn more than $2 million a year.
Yep. And would be a great deal for them then.
Yeah, it would be a great deal for them because they, if they're already paying premiums, they get to keep, and typically that's about 22% of payroll. So they get to keep a lot of money that they can do other things with in their business. If they're not paying premiums, they get the owner and the employees coverage that they have not been able to have and can stabilize their workforces.
Okay. Dan, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. That's a very good point because that's a question that's got to come up for a lot of people. And I'm surprised that I thought the ceiling was going to be lower than $2 million. So that helps a lot of, among other things, that helps a lot of things like sole proprietors, mom and pop businesses that maybe only have two or three employees if they have that.
Well, it basically takes business out of, it takes them out of the business that they're not in, or it lets them focus on the business that they are in.
Yeah. See, we got hit here real hard, so let's just go ahead and get some of these callers through here. I apologize. Angie from San Luis Obispo, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, sure. I wanted to throw kind of a wrench in the works and talk about drug costs and whether that's part of anybody's plan for reforming the healthcare system.
Go ahead, Susan. Yeah.
I'll address that from the perspective of SB 562 or a single-payer approach. One of the real benefits for that in California, and one of the ways in which this saves money, is that that a single-payer approach would transform California into a player that can negotiate prices for drugs. So, and we could expect to get the kind of discounts that Canada currently gets because California is a bigger market than all of Canada. So we can have the potential to cut deals for better prices on drugs, and the expected savings are part of what makes the approach affordable.
You know, the irony here, and thank you for bringing up drug costs, Angie, is when Medicare, which previously did not cover prescription drugs, added it as a benefit maybe 10 years ago, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, actually forbade the federal government, who is the largest purchaser of drugs, to negotiate prices. I mean, so when Susan talks about we could, and yes, we've always been able to, except for some reason.
Well, there's political will.
Absolutely.
So the whole question comes down to politics, as usual. Anybody have a solution for that?
That's probably a topic for another 20 programs down the
campaign
line.
Campaign donations.
Anyway, Angie, thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Okay. Boy, we are popular. Okay, let me see. Steve in San Luis Obispo. Steve, you're on the air. Jump on in.
Hi, folks. I'm Dr. Steve Hansen. I know some of you, and I've represented Central Coast doctors at California Medical and the American Medical Association as their delegate for over 20 years, and know a little bit about this. Endless debates, of course, at the state and federal level. However, the primary care docs now support the notion of single payer, and it would do a lot of things to get rid of unnecessary costs in the system. Insurance companies are an unnecessary, no value added part of our current equation. Employer-related coverage was an anomaly that rose out of government cost controls in World War II, and Kaiser added it on as a benefit to help attract workers there. In Switzerland, the next most expensive country to us as far as healthcare goes, saves about a third by their plebiscite that included mandatory cost controls, and doctors and drug companies and insurers have to every 2 years negotiate new price levels. There are inbred costs in our system, which are very bad for it. The cost of a medical education leaves people with great indebtedness, and so they turn to procedural-based specialties, which pay about four times more than primary care might, for example, and that raises costs for everybody and leads to primary care being lacking, and that's preventive medicine. Back office care, very high, just to shuffle the insurance papers. You don't have that in Canada and other places. Might be one person in the office with the nurse and the doctor. And there's a lot of things to be said for a single-payer primary care-based support system. Look at even Cuba, for example, with excellent statistics for the most part, with hardly any, you know, high-tech support for that.
Steve, this is Fred. Let me jump in with a question. I'm curious. Has there been a shift among primary care physicians in support of single payer?
Yes,
and if so, what brought that about?
Physicians, family practice doctors are in favor. Of course, the devil's always in the details, but the more details you can get rid of, you don't need employers. You don't even have to have a workers' comp system if everybody's covered for everything. See all the various savings that are in there. And then then you can control drug costs and other things in a sensible way. Without the insurance industry underfoot, there's a 15% savings or more. And it makes no sense to continue as we are now. And in fact, everybody agrees we can't afford it in the long run with an aging population and increasing cost care. Almost a million of us are going to get an artificial joint this year.
A lot of us are going to get a real joint this year. It's a different issue, but yeah. Sorry. I couldn't pass it up. I'm sorry. Anyway, Steve, thanks for your insights, because I wasn't aware that the physicians were moving in this direction, so I appreciate your call.
There'll still be some wailing and gnashing of teeth among the procedural-based specialists who are paid for doing things.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
So I have a question. Steve said insurance companies do nothing. Now, I'm not a big fan of insurance companies. I pay them a lot of money. I don't get a lot from them.
Sure.
But, you know, I was thinking of something as I was bicycling over here. And so we have – take SenCal, and I don't know why I'm on SenCal's – good side this week. So they're a managed care plan, but they're a single payer plan. They are paid entirely, you know, from state and federal money, and CHC is one of its biggest providers. But they are a health plan, and they are a managed care organization. So I don't know whether we think that is bad, you know, even though they are a single payer, but they try and also manage costs and manage care, and that both controls access, but it also helps people get care. I mean, because they're actually able to find providers and contract with far-flung hospitals and perhaps arrange transportation. So I don't know whether we're looking, you know, whether all health plans are bad under single payer, or we're looking at a payment system and one that can help negotiate with all the providers.
Well, I want to jump in for a second, and Frederick, because I want to bring you back into the conversation. I'm wondering, as an organization, and I realize you're the guy for your organization that looks at the interface between the Affordable Care Act and mm-hmm. the services you provide.
Correct.
Is the shakeup in Washington making your people nervous, or is there a feeling that California will come out on its feet regardless of what happens?
Well, I mean, I think the way that we look at it is that CHC is always going to be there for our patients and our community regardless of what's happening on a national level or on a state level. And what I can say is that, you know, specifically the funding cliff coming up, you know, things could have a significant impact on community health centers on a national level. I can't really speak about what's happening right now, but we're fairly confident with our current access, with new clinics opening up, that we're able to sustain and be a support system to our community and our existing patient population. So it's very important for us to make sure that our community and our patients know we're always going to be there. Our doors are always going to be open for them. And that's really important to remember.
But you have to, as an organization, you have to look at whether or not you're going to have to struggle for funding.
Sure, and I think that's a natural reaction, but I think that we're trying to be less reactive and more proactive, okay. And that's really important for mm-hmm. us too.
Yeah, and I think one of the really valuable things that I'd like to hear from Frederick is about how when the Affordable Care Act was passed, how that ramped up and how were people actually able to get care? Because one of the big concerns that I hear from people is if everybody else gets in health insurance that doesn't have it now, I won't be able to get the care that I need because there aren't enough doctors and care out there, and I'll have to wait in a long line. So the real test of that was a common fear when the Affordable Care Act was passed and the number of people who had access to insurance expanded significantly at one time.
Interesting is in the beginning, I think a lot of people were worried about how this was going to affect not just community health centers, but also just your regular old private practices. And in the beginning, everyone was just trying to get coverage. I think that they immediately realized not a lot of physicians were contracted with the private plans in the individual market, which then made them feel like there wasn't a lot of access available. But for many of the people that we assisted, we made sure that they knew that we were accepting those insurances and that we were able to see those patients. And so we found a lot of people coming to us simply because they couldn't go anywhere else. And that was really interesting for us, too. So I think that from that perspective, you know, the access is there. We did feel an impact. We still feel the impact. But we, again, are just trying to be more proactive about those approaches instead of just being constantly reactive.
Yeah, good point. Thank you. Let me say, Catherine from Paso Robles, thanks for your patience. You still there?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question for Susan. Where is who would be the winners and the losers if SB 562 becomes law?
Oh, that's a great question. Thanks, Catherine. The winners, really, first of all, everybody in California would be a winner in the sense that everyone would have access to health insurance and health care, and not without the constraints of cost. But it's also on the provider side, there's a lot of concern about, you know, who wins and who loses. And obviously the insurance companies who are currently making money in this market would lose that opportunity for this market. And it is, you know, then they fight against single payer to protect that opportunity for profitability. You also see differences in how this affects on the physician side. We heard a little earlier from Dr. Hansen, who's a primary care physician, that a lot of primary care physicians are supportive of single payer, and that they see the patients that can't get care. Also, the physicians who see lots of Medi-Cal patients and Medicare patients would be winners in this system, because if their reimbursement comes up to the Medicare level, then they're not being penalized for seeing patients who are currently less profitable to them. If everybody gets paid the same, it's not as lucrative for doctors who have focused their practices on well-insured, privately insured patients for whom they can charge lots of money, and who have positioned their practices as premium providers of service and care in a way that they can charge lots of money for it. They'll have a harder time financially because that high cost they currently can charge will come down.
Frederick, are organizations like yours in support of this kind of legislation? Or I realize we put you on a spot because you work for a large organization.
Sure.
And you're not a spokesman from a political standpoint from them. But what is the general feeling among your colleagues?
I don't know that we necessarily look at things in terms of like single payer perspectives, but I think that it's important for us to make sure that we're abreast of what's really happening so that we can make sure that our patients are informed and really take that back down to the community that we're serving. So I really can't tell you if there's an affliction for for single payer or not, because I think that we are so adaptable to whichever direction goes, as our model is based on, you know, seeing uninsured people, whether they have insurance or not, whether it's a single payer or not. The organization itself and FQHCs are meant to really be adaptable to those changes.
Do you currently see patients that have, let's say, Anthem Blue Cross type programs and things like that also? So any patient can come to your clinic?
That is correct.
Clinic.
Okay. That is correct.
Okay. Do you tend to – is the vast majority of your patient population still people who are in what we would consider the social safety net of medical coverage?
For the most part. I mean, it really depends on your geographic region within either county that we serve. But for the most part, yes. And we're seeing just a large variety of all types of insurance plans coming through, not just patients on Medi-Cal, but patients who have private insurance who covered California, who have just been very happy with their care and the way that things work at CHC. And we really try to make it equal along all of our encounters. Everyone is treated the same way. So I think that that's really important too. And we're available through, you know, we're easy to get a hold of. You know, anyone can call 805-361-8400 or look up community health centers and get a hold of one of us. Also, our certified enrollment counselors are available in our call center every day, Monday through Friday.
So people who may be getting covered California coverage through other avenues but still can – your people can still work with them if they're
absolutely
for open enrollment or enrollment issues also.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's see, we've got Joel in Lompoc, not to be confused with the Joel in the room. Joel, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'd just like to remind people that my understanding is there are many doctors that will take cash and that you don't need insurance, and the doctors often don't get more than the copay anyway. And I've been able to get by on that, and it's I'm fortunate. And also, the insurance companies rarely pay more than half of what they see on a bill. And if you go to a hospital in advance for a procedure, you can pay as little as 50% of what the first numbers they give you is. And they don't tell you that unless you ask. You got to ask. And you can avoid having insurance if you stay healthy and don't have a major catastrophe. Yeah. And most people don't. And that's basically it.
Yeah.
You don't need to go to the emergency room. You can, if you have a family doctor, which I've asked people, a lot of people don't. They have great insurance, but they don't have a doctor.
Yeah.
And I have a doctor I can call up and I can make an appointment, and for $50. It's gone up. It's now $50 now. And I think a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
Thanks, Fred.
Very good point, Joel. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's a difference between care and coverage.
Right.
Coverage does not guarantee you care, and you can get care without coverage. But, you know, when we use the term insurance, yes, it is to take care of those unpredictable circumstances, like getting hit by a car.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. And that will bankrupt you.
Right.
And, in fact, before the Affordable Care Act, medical debt was one of the largest reasons for families declaring bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something to consider if you have assets to protect, that you don't, you know, if you don't want to have to declare bankruptcy in a pinch, then you really should have health insurance. Because if with health insurance you get those discounts, and without it, you may be able to go along for a long time like our caller does and be all right. But the minute anything happens to you, just if you overheat at the 4th of July parade and pass out, you, by the time you come to in that ambulance on the way to the hospital, you have a $2,500 ambulance bill, and you have, and you're looking at thousands of dollars of emergency room, and you didn't even get to say yes.
I think that it's something that just resonates for me, is just the simple phrase of, it's just not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I think that that's really important for people to remember, because I don't, at least in my experience speaking with people who are trying to get health insurance or trying to grasp why it's so important for them to have it, it's just really, it's important for people to remember that, because I feel like that's not usually one of the things that they're thinking about when they're looking to decide whether or not they want coverage or need it, or either one of those two things.
Yeah, very good point. Susan, it's interesting. I've had people in the course of conversations about this. The perception of a lot of people is, you know, I don't need insurance in the case of like Joel's reference. I don't need insurance because I can negotiate a decent price. And if I really need something catastrophic, the hospital is not going to turn me away. And I think that's a perception of a lot of people that I think is still a factor there. And I've read it in some recent journalism. I've read it in some talking to some people about the fact that there seems to be a perception that since no hospital is going to turn you away if you're having a heart attack, no hospital is going to turn you away if you're having a stroke. I'll just worry about whether or not I can afford to pay for this later on. I'll just be glad to still be alive. So I don't know how that fits into that. That may be the perception of a number of people, but I think it may be a perception of a lot of millennials that are the ones that they are most concerned about dropping off the insurance pool now because of the mandate not being required. Mm-hmm. How's that being addressed?
Well, one way it was being addressed was by having a mandate.
Sure.
Because the reason why we had the individual mandate, which was originally a Republican idea coming out of the Heritage Foundation, mm-hmm. ironically.
That might be most ironic thing I've heard so far in the program.
It was because, as Susan was explaining, if you say to insurance companies you must insure everyone without doing medical underwriting, without picking and choosing and cherry picking who you want as your clients or members, then everyone has to be in the pool. It's called community rating, and it's called all of us being in there. And it's to avoid freeloaders, because those who say, oh, well, there are 80% other people with insurance who are keeping the hospitals alive, so I can do that. I can just glom on to them, and the hospital will be there. So the system really, you know, and what makes Europe different than the U.S. is we're very individuals. I can do it myself. And Europe says, what do we as a community, we as a nation, we as a people want for all of us? And that's fundamentally the difference, because healthcare is a right in every other developed country except for ours. But with rights also come responsibilities, and everyone pays in.
Well, interesting point you bring up, because I'm curious, other than the United States, is there any developed country that falls in the category of not providing some form of universal healthcare?
No.
No.
Okay.
No, we're the only developed country that does not.
No, when I was getting my master's in public health, and we had to take a health a class, and we were sitting there, it was on ethics. And I was sitting there, this is right after the Berlin Wall fell, and it was a very international group in there. And there was a whole thing about, is healthcare a right? And sitting next to me, one of my co-students, who is a physician from Germany, says, why are we having this conversation? He had not a clue. And I said, because in the U.S., healthcare is not a right. It really depends on whether you can afford it.
Well, we only got a couple minutes left, but I need to interject. And it was in some of your notes also that there's still a significant perception in this country that socialized medicine, can't think of a better word for it, but it's what's referenced in as far as the Canadian system and the British system, is inferior care. Allegedly, there's this mass of people who come across the northern border of the United States for health care because they're just not getting it with the included health care in Canada. And everything I'm reading seems to contradict that, but there still seems to be this incredible perception that that's the way it is. Is that just propaganda?
Well, there are facts and there are perceptions.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I have yet to meet a Canadian, any Canadian, that would willingly trade their healthcare system for ours. And one of the things that you have with an organized system where everyone gets care is the system will ensure that the people who need the most care right now get that care first, and sometimes other people wait a little bit longer. So if you've got an old athletic injury that's harming your knee, you might have to wait a little longer to get the MRI and get the surgery. And the idea that you're going to just get it right away, which we all, as Americans, we always want it right now.
We want to be privileged and entitled, yes.
But in fact, we don't have that right. We wait now. My mother got her knee replaced and had to wait about 6 months. And that's
And I also think that it is a little broad because, I mean, what is good healthcare anyway? Like, I think it's really hard to define. I think everyone has a different perception of that. And I think that that's really difficult. You know, some people think that just a doctor who gives them whatever they want is good healthcare. But does that mean that you think that? You know, so I think that it's really important for us to remember those things, too.
Yeah. Well, and that brings us to, as a lot of our listeners know, I try and get out of the way from my guests for a while in the last few minutes. And Frederick, since you had the floor, I'll let you continue. What do you want to make sure we go away with and don't forget?
Thanks. So it's first and foremost, I want to make sure that our listeners and our community have our phone number. So our certified enrollment counselors can be reached Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. We're available through a toll-free number, so anyone can call us toll-free. The number is 844-361-8573. Again, that's 844-361-8573. And we can also help people connect to primary care physicians. We are helping people figure out how to navigate the complexities of their situation, self-employed individuals who are having a hard time figuring out whether what the right plan is for them, and connecting them to services if they need it, whether they have insurance or not. So really important. Also, just a reminder about our open enrollment event at Community Health Center, 77 Casa Street, Saturday, on the, I believe, what is Saturday, the 13th. And from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., it's a walk-in. You don't need appointments. But we do expect most enrollments last anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes. So always plan for a little bit of that time.
Okay. When does the open enrollment period end? Not necessarily what you're doing, but when the official open enrollment period ends.
Sure. So open enrollment closes on January 31st
of this month. Okay.
Yep. So we're getting close to the wire, which in my experience, most people like to wait till the last minute.
Yeah.
So
understood.
We're ready for the influx.
Yeah. Joel.
So I think, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about health care and how to pay for it, but we haven't really talked about what we get for all that spending and all that care. And I'm much more interested in sort of the outcomes and the health that we're trying to promote and create. And I think we should probably spend a lot more time talking about prevention and lifestyle and looking at how we can promote health than worrying so deeply about the excess and excessive costs of the actual care delivery, which in fact only promotes about 20% of our health. So, you know, so much else is related to our environment, to our behaviors, and to our genetics that we really need to keep the whole debate into some perspective and think about what it takes to be healthy.
But, Joel, that may include not being fun. You must have seen what I ate for lunch today in the car, I guess. Sorry. Thanks very much. Susan.
Well, I think as we wrestle with these issues and look for a pathway forward in healthcare, it helps, first of all, to think about what we actually want out of our healthcare system. And I think most of us want to have access to good health care when we need it, and have the people we love have that access, have it not be a huge hassle, and have it not cost a mint. And that gets us to understanding of health care as a right, something that as a civilized society we want to see ourselves and the people we love and the people that everybody else loves to have that right to have access to it. And if we start to look at that's the goal, the way we have the healthcare system set up right now does not easily get us to that goal. It's really not well designed for that purpose. And if you look at – that's why single-payer approaches become so attractive, is because they are really about getting to that kind of goal for those times when we can't be healthy, as Joel noted. And we need care. We need a system that will deliver that. One of the things in looking at the SB 562 in its financing study is that actually if you pay for all of that care so that the doctors get paid the same for every patient and do that at roughly Medicare rates, that and you'll let the state negotiate better prices for drug comp- for drugs and use its market power, that you actually can deliver, have coverage for everyone that's reasonably comprehensive at a lower cost than is currently being spent right now for health care for Californians, because there is so much waste in our system, and we really can organize it in a way that is much more efficient and is easier for the hospitals and the doctors to deal with, and delivers a better and more satisfying outcome for our people.
I want to, we've got a little bit more, so I just want to interject. Is any other state being as progressive in exploring these alternatives as the state of California?
There are other states that are looking at this also. New York has looked at it, Vermont, Colorado. Some states are trying different things. And certainly California has been more upfront in developing Covered California and, you know, taking that challenge on. Other states have been much more resistive even to that and have refused to have the Medicaid element for their low-income people.
Thanks very much. Folks,
and the one thing to remember, to do any of this, you need the agreement of the federal government, which already pays for half of health care. Mm-hmm. So we need a progressive federal administration that will allow this to happen, Angie.
That's something that we can look at for probably the next too many years, but I won't go there anymore. Sorry about that. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I want to remind folks that that next week I'll be with you again based upon the rotation and Chris Kington Barker being out of town. You get to listen to me for another week. And next week we're going to have an interesting program about the new abolitionism, which is basically ending cash, the bail bonding. The momentum is building in many communities to reform how this is looked at. According to a recent report, the system is considered both unsafe and unfair, and it basically looks at socioeconomic disparity and racial issues that affect a lot of people who have to make bail. It's a topic you may not have thought about very much, but it's a topic that we do address and want to address next week. There's resistance to this change, of course, because people like bail bondsmen and bail bonds industry, if you will, not necessarily men, sorry, really are kind of opposed to this. But next week I'm going to get to speak with Barry Price, Dr. Patricia Gordon, and Dr. Ellie Axelroth, pardon me. And they are part of Bend the Arc San Luis Obispo County, which is wanting to discuss how to do away with the cash bail bonding system in the state of California. It's really something that's going to be – we may not have thought about it, and hopefully you haven't thought about it because you haven't had to post bail for anything for a long, long time or at all. But that'll be the program next week. Want to also remind you that Central Coast Voices is a production in association with KCBX of the Community Action for Healthy Communities. Having trouble with my own notes today. Sorry about that. Part of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. The program is underwritten through an underwriting grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org and voices@kcbx.org or 543-2323. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you to my guests today, Frederick, Joel, and Susan. We had a lively topic, and I appreciate that. Up next is This American Life, my favorite program on, say, KCBX. Thank you. We'll see you all next week.